welcome to another edition of Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved in punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, reconnecting with someone that I've haven't seen in a long time. You may know him from the band The Vatican Commandos. You may know him from the band AWOL. You may also know him from his solo records, which have, you know, been pretty popular over the years. Today on the show, my buddy, I haven't seen him forever, though, Moby, and I get to reconnect. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. You can send me an email there. It's run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham. Tristan will get the message to me and we can communicate that way. He also runs a Facebook page and an Instagram page. Both of those are respectively Turned Out a Punk. Is there their titles at Turned Out a Punk, I guess, on Instagram and however that works on Facebook. There's also a Tumblr page, but I don't think we update that anymore. So don't worry about the Tumblr page. So you can send the messages to him and he'll get the messages to me. If you want to get in touch with me directly, you can find me on various forms of social media at Left4Damien. And you can send me messages there and we can communicate that way. But I don't check those too often, so if I'm slow in getting back to those, I apologize. Send Tristan the message. He and I talk all the time, every day. If you want to support the show, the best way to support the show is just by telling everyone you know about it, letting everyone know that you know out there that we're doing this thing and that you enjoy it. That's the best way to support it. You can also support it by heading over to patreon.com/turnedoutapunk. And thank you to everyone that does that. Check out footnotes over there and other fun stuff. And I really do appreciate all the Patreon supporters immensely. Speaking of support, this thing would not be possible. The kind, loving support of Vans, who came aboard a few years ago and said, Damien, do what you do. Just don't lose money at it anymore. And they've helped me kind of cover the cost of this thing, which has been really great, and thank you very much to them for doing that. You can also support this podcast, though, by subscribing to it and rating it on your platform of choice. And thank you to all those people that do that. You know, I really appreciate it. Even the negative ones, you know, it's constructive criticism that I need, you know? That's what we all respond to. All right, today on the show, Moby is here. Now, Moby is someone that I'm sure, well, everyone... You know, my family and people like that are familiar with because of his massive success in the world of popular music. And also he's had, you know, like a real kind of key role in dance music and the rise of dance music throughout the 80s and into the 90s. But for a lot of us as punk hardcore kids, we know that Moby is someone that came out of hardcore bands. Moby, of course, played in the Vatican Commandos and also the phenomenal AWOL as well. And he's someone that I got to meet, you know, we talk about this in the episode, so you're going to hear this in a second anyway, but it's someone I got to meet playing this wild, fucked up show that was 12 hours years ago. And then I got to hang out with more recently and talk about punk, interviewing him for this video project, which hasn't come out yet, but I really got a sense that punk rock deeply affected Moby. And for as big as he got as a pop star and as like sort of this story whacking things hanging from my ceiling, as big as he became as a pop star and a pop culture figure, punk rock is something that you know, hung heavy on him. You'll hear what I'm talking about in this show. Some notes: I did not bother relitigating that whole Flipper discussion. If you're unfamiliar with it, there's countless interviews with Flipper where they talk about it. But I have recently seen footage of Moby playing with Flipper, so you know I didn't force him to have to rediscuss that thing on here. But we do have a really fun conversation about punk rock and the importance of it and where it went. And anyway, I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Moby on Turned Out a Punk. Moby, thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
Well, as we were just reminiscing off air, we've actually collaborated in a live setting before when you came up and joined Fucked Up for some songs years ago. So thank you once again for doing that, by the way.
Yeah, that was such an odd experience because I lived at the time on Mott Street in Lower Manhattan, and it was summertime, if I remember correctly. And so I got this message, did I want to come play a couple songs with you guys at like 3 p.m. at some random space on the Bowery? And I didn't know what to expect. And I walk in, it's 140 degrees there. In a space that would comfortably hold 50 people, there are probably 300 people in there. Yeah. And if I remember correctly, we played a Ramones song, and I'm not sure if we also played a Minor Threat song.
And a Vatican Commando song, too.
Oh, that's right. So it's just like, boom, 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 get covered in sweat, and then I went home and, you know, made tea and read The New Yorker. It was just such a really odd punk rock experience.
Well, it was. And I think actually, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you even actually had to go immediately afterwards off to a friend's child's christening or something. Like you had to like make a mad dash. You were just like, you know, total, like, you know, hats off to you for doing this, but came in, played the songs, and then had to take off into the afternoon.
Yep, I'm sure. Yeah, that, something just random and strange and demanding.
Well, once again, I appreciate you doing it. And as much as I appreciate you doing this tonight, because it's going to be a lot of fun talking about this, because I think AWOL is a criminally underrated band.
I don't know if AWOL would be considered a punk rock band. Do you know, and this is, basically I was in two bands in high school. I was in the Vatican Commandos, which was a hardcore band, and then AWOL, which my goal with AWOL was for us to sound sort of like Joy Division and Echo and the Bunnymen.
Well, I lump both of those groups into the punk rock, especially with in the case of the Joy Division, but we'll get to all that in 1 second. But I want to start off the way they all start off on this show. Moby, how did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
Yes. As a matter of fact, it's one of two things, and I'll tell you both of them. The first was, there was a writer for Saturday Night Live named Mike O'Donohue, and he went by Mr. Mike. And he put out this weird movie called Mr. Mike's Mondo Video. And all it was, this was pre-internet, pre-YouTube, this would have been 1978, 79, it was just a collection of his favorite random video clips, and he released it as a movie. And for some reason, my mom and I went to go see it at an art house theater in Norwalk, Connecticut. And it was a bunch of random clips like cats jumping off diving boards, etc. Just random stupidity. But one of the best things in it is he had Sid Vicious singing My Way, which was from Great Rock and Roll Swindle. Mm-hmm. And I remember, because if you've seen this clip of Sid Vicious doing My Way, like the first minute and a half is him doing a kind of shitty, ironic version of traditional My Way. And then it becomes a 1970s punk rock version of My Way. And I remember sitting in the theater and I just thought, like, what is this? Like, I had heard of Sid Vicious. He might have even still been, he was probably dead at that time. I don't know. But so I saw that and I just thought it was so fascinating. And then there was a radio station in New York called WNEW, and it was a commercial station, but they occasionally played new wave. Like, I heard Gary Numan and Elvis Costello, but they played, and I taped this on my grandfather's dictaphone. They played I Fought the Law, the Clash cover song. And I didn't know what the Clash were singing, but I recorded it off the radio, and I kept listening to it because it really is this, like, very, like, one of the fastest early punk rock songs. And I just, between Sid Vicious singing My Way and recording the Clash off the radio, I just thought it all was so exciting and subversive, because keeping in mind, in Connecticut at that time, like, the status quo was guitar rock. It was the Kinks and the Who, and it was classic rock. And I had a guitar teacher who only liked guitar solos, and he just thought that punk rock was the stupidest thing he'd ever heard because there were no real guitar solos. And so I had to like hear this music and find this music and love this music on my own in private. You know, because you couldn't go to school and say to people like, "Hey, have you heard The Clash?" Because like you would get maligned as, you know, I'm not allowed to say what we were called at the time, but like it, trust me, it was some really bad epithets.
Yeah, it was like definitely like an outside perspective to be into punk rock at that time.
It was so obscure that it was like, yeah, I mean, like there are things that you weren't allowed to do. You weren't allowed to like David Bowie,
mm-hmm.
And you weren't allowed to like new wave and punk rock. And this was, you know, 1978, 1979. And then I remember my friends Jim and Dave, we somehow confessed to each other that we all liked new wave and punk rock. It was like a dirty secret. It was like, and then we started like buying punk rock, like saving up money to buy punk rock records. And then I remember my friend Paul Johnson came back from England and his brother had a copy of Nevermind the Bollocks and he loaned it to me. And I just thought, what in the, like, this is the most terrifying, exciting thing I've ever heard in my entire life.
It's still a perfect record when you go back and listen to it. Like, it's amazing how it sounds just as fresh today.
Well, it's funny because I've become pretty good friends with Steve Jones. And if you're, back in the 70s, the thing about punk rock is everyone always said, like, they couldn't play. You know, the musicians mm-hmm. didn't know how to play their instruments. But if you go back and listen to The Damned and The Clash and The Sex Pistols and Susie and the Banshees and all the early bands, they were all great musicians and they made great sounding records. So I don't know where this, they don't know how to play and they made terrible sounding records came from. Like, because that Nevermind the Bollocks or the first Clash, every Clash album, like sonically, they're phenomenal and they're really well-written songs and beautifully played. So, you know, they were a lot better musicians than anyone ever gave them credit for.
Absolutely. And like you're saying, like it those records sound so good. Like it's funny how records that came out a few years later sound way more dated than those records today.
Yeah. Cause I mean, they were made in really nice studios with mm-hmm. great microphones and 24 track 2-inch tape machines. Like they used great equipment and they ended up with great sounding records.
And so going back before you got into the punk rock stuff, what kind of music were you into?
I was exposed to music through my mom because she had this great, weird, eclectic record collection. You know, she had everything from Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young to Dvorak to Stravinsky to John Coltrane. The story she always told me is that I was conceived while she and my dad were listening to A Love Supreme by John Coltrane. That might just be her version of all my family's dead, so I can't ask anyone, but I love that little bit of possible apocrypha.
Absolutely.
So basically I had her records and then I had what was played on the radio, but I also was an insecure little kid and I wanted to like the records that the cool kids liked, which was Pink Floyd and The Who, and Led Zeppelin. And at the time I didn't really like any of that music, but I pretended to because that was how you endeared yourself to the cool kids. Since then I've gone back and I've learned to love Led Zeppelin. I still don't like The Who that much, but like, you know, I really like classic rock now, but at the time I just pretended to like it until I discovered Devo and the Sex Pistols.
And so I guess like, were you a fan of Saturday Night Live too, going to see that movie?
Oh yeah. I mean, I remember having a sleepover at my friend Brian Hochstein's when we were in sixth grade and somehow this was maybe the first year SNL or first or second year, you know, with Gilda Radner, John Belushi. And somehow we saw it. Like we stayed up and watched it on low volume so his parents wouldn't wake up. And we just thought like, we had discovered the weirdest subculture in the world. And then, of course, years later, there was that amazing performance of with Fear on SNL.
Absolutely. Yeah. Legendary now.
Yeah, with Ian MacKaye and John Joseph in the audience.
But, like, I guess even before that, though, like, Devo and the B-52s were kind of showing up there, right? Like, I guess they have kind of famous performances in that early run of seasons.
Yeah, I mean, I was really lucky because I lived in Darien, Connecticut, you know, this very wealthy town, even though my mom and I were poor white trash on food stamps and welfare. But because we were close to Manhattan, you know, we got weird radio stations from New York, and you had SNL and, you know, a weird record stores nearby where you could, you know, I couldn't afford the records, but I would go and like pick up the first Devo album and hold it and wonder what it sounded like and wonder if it sounded as weird as it looked.
I guess, like, yeah, going, like, where were you picking up records when you were eventually able to pick up records? Like, you know, had to...
In terms of buying records?
Yeah.
There was a record store in my town called Johnny's, and it started off as a head shop. You know, they sold, like, rolling papers and bongs, and then they started selling records, and they sold a lot of terrible hippie records, and, like, Grateful Dead bootlegs and things. But Johnny, who ran the store, was this wonderful weirdo. And so when new wave and punk rock happened, he started selling that. And, you know, and my friends and I, like I said, we couldn't afford the records, but we would go in and just, like, you know, just look at them, just, you know, just hold them. And then eventually, by like cutting lawns and doing odd jobs, we saved enough money to start being able to buy records. And then this magic moment, I think in eighth or ninth grade, we all saved enough money to go into Manhattan and go record shopping in New York City.
Where did you go when you went to Manhattan to go record shopping? Do you remember?
There was J&R Music World down by Wall Street. And then we started finding, like, as we got into high school and got a little bit older, like 15, 16, we discovered there was Rocks in Your Head. What were Bleaker Bob's Sounds? I just all these weird little like new wave punk rock record stores.
I guess later on, would you have gone to Rat Cage too? I would imagine.
Rat Cage, I don't remember that being a record store.
Okay, I think they had maybe they just had a storefront for like a brief little window.
I remember seeing, like, I remember walking by it and seeing like some of the East Village punk rock guys hanging out there, but I thought it was a record label and not a record store. So no, as far as I know, I don't think I ever bought a record there.
And I guess going back to like, you know, before in Connecticut, before, I guess even before you went to Manhattan, what was the first concert you went to? It doesn't have to be punk necessarily.
The first concert I went to was Yes at Madison Square Garden.
Oh, that's a great one.
I love Yes. Like, I know we're talking about punk rock, but boy, do I mean, you know, Close to the Edge and, you know, are phenomenal. So I was, I think 12, probably, yeah, 12, maybe 13. And my friend Mike McCarthy got us tickets to go see Yes at Madison Square Garden. And it was awesome. And then a couple of years later, I remember my first ever punk rock show. I got really lucky because I saw Fear at the Mud Club.
Oh, what a show.
So it was, that would have been 80, 81. I don't, or definitely the early 80s, you know, like right after that Fear the Record came out.
So that was before the SNL appearance, I guess?
It would have been right. Maybe it was the same, like maybe they were playing the Mud Club the night before SNL. I don't know. But my friends and I drove it. We basically stole a car. Well, we borrowed it without telling the person we were borrowing it, which I guess is called, that's stealing. And we drove in thinking, okay, this is great. No one's going to know. We're going to sneak into the city, see this punk rock show and drive back and no one will ever know. And of course the car broke down, you know, on Canal Street. And so we had to like, didn't get home until 5 a.m, got in all sorts of trouble. We didn't get arrested, but we got to see Fear at the Mud Club. So it was worth it.
And I guess like, what was that show like vibe wise? Cause I can't imagine they would have done too many tours. So I guess it would have been right around that SNL appearance, which is pretty hectic from the recorded record. So what was that show like from your memory?
It was okay. So here's, and I don't know if you or the people listening will have had this experience, but like hardcore shows, I mean, shows in general back then, half of the show was the band and the music. And the other half was simply the fact that you were part of this scene. Mm-hmm. You know, like going, like being in lower Manhattan in 1980 or 81, whenever it was, and seeing other punk rockers, because like where we were, there were none. Like we didn't know, we lived in suburban Connecticut. Like we didn't know of anybody. And the fact that there were like people with tattoos and people with piercings, like we thought that was equally as exciting as seeing Fear and hearing them. Just being in the present, being in this like dingy nightclub, you know, at midnight, in 1980 or 81, being surrounded by subversive punk rockers, like that was as good as the music.
Oh yeah. And especially like the people, you know, that would have been in that room are like the people that would have been the foundation of New York hardcore, you know, a few years later, or even right around then too, I would imagine.
Yeah. I mean, it was, my friends and I were a little bit younger. Like we were probably 14, 15. So we were too scared and we were little, you know, like, I mean, none of us were more than 5'8" or 5'9". So like, and some of these punk rockers, they were tough, you know, like there were the nerdy, skinny little suburban punk rockers. And then you had like, you know, the Murphy's Law, Cro-Mags, yeah, Misfits, et cetera. Who, I mean, these were big, scary people.
Yeah.
They've since all become friends of mine. But like at the time when you're 14 years old and 5'7", and there's John Joseph stage diving, you're like, you don't even feel like you're allowed to look at him.
Yeah. I was going to say at 40 years old and 6'1", 200 pounds, I would be scared shitless in that room.
Yeah. So especially for the first, you know, the first punk rock show we ever went to. And I think, I'm trying to think what the second one, oh, and then, and I don't want to ramble on too much because I'm
this
sure
is
that
all we this is what this whole show's built for. So please,
oh, okay,
go
then, great.
On.
So I'll,
absolutely.
So I'll ramble on. So then magic happened, and this guy, Mark Mulcahy, I think that was his name. He was in a legendary indie rock band that Tom York loved, but that was later on. Oh, I forget his name. And he started booking hardcore shows at a club in Bridgeport, Connecticut called Pogo's. And it was named after the cartoon character, not the dance.
Okay, yeah.
And it was this shitty little Irish bar with a stage. And it was our version of CBGB's. Like, he talked them in to letting him throw shows. And I think the first show I vaguely remember seeing there was the Bad Brains.
Oh, amazing.
And, but this was, so suddenly, you know, we were still working up our nerve to go into the city, to go to CB's and A7 and Great Gildersleeves and, you know, all these places. But we could also drive 25 minutes and go to hardcore shows basically in our neighborhood. And everybody, because it was in between New York and Boston, everybody played there. Like, as a resource, I can't, like, the Misfits played there, the Circle Jerks, the Gun Club, Flipper, every small hardcore band, every big hardcore band, like, everybody just, you know, it was, like, at the time, we sort of took it for granted, not realizing what an amazing resource this was.
Well, I think you're also just speaking to what an amazing era that was for just music in general, but specifically punk music and hardcore music. But just like, that's like a who's who of bands in the genre.
Yeah. And the place maybe held 75 people, but because it was in between, you know, New York and Boston, everybody played there, you know, and then what was really exciting is my friends and I started a band after seeing Fear. We were like, okay, we're going to start a punk rock band. And then we found out there were all these other punk rock bands being started in Connecticut at exactly the same time. Mm-hmm. And so we had a scene, you know, like, and it was really, we had a scene, and then we had our fanzine called CUD, the Connecticut Underground Dispatch. And the bands, I don't know if you've heard, the bands were Seizure, 76% Uncertain, Reflex from Pain, Violent Children, who became Youth of Today, Young Republicans, who also became Youth of Today, No Milk on Tuesday, all these, you know, really interesting Connecticut hardcore bands.
Yeah, like obviously some of those bands go on to become legendary on their own right, and some of those bands go on to become members of legendary bands, or some members, I should say, go on to become members of other legendary bands. But it's also, I think, awesome about that scene is that all those bands kind of sound different too, yourselves included. Like it's not like there's a defined sound. Like everything's fast and aggressive, but everyone's kind of taking it a slightly different approach to it, it seemed.
Yeah, because we are basically, and I think this is the genesis of every great scene, is ultimately you're just an excited fan and you want to sound like your heroes. Mm-hmm. You know, so like we, like in Vatican Commandos, like we loved Minor Threat and we loved The Clash and we loved Circle Jerks and Black Flag and Bad Brains and we loved the Damned, Machine Gun Etiquette. And we were like, okay, how do we sound like those things? Like it wasn't, in a way, there was never any effort made to be original. The goal was simply to enthusiastically sound like your heroes.
And the thing about the Vatican Commandos is like, you can kind of hear elements of that. Not so much of the Damned, I guess. But like, maybe that's just, I'm not hearing it. I go back and listen to that 7-inch again. How did that 7-inch come together, Hit Squad for God?
And the Damned, I think it's more, especially the album Machine Gun Etiquette. I mean, I think arguably if I had to pick like top three best early-ish punk rock records, that Never Mind the Bollocks and the first Clash album, like, I mean, Machine Gun Etiquette. And I almost feel like, in a way, the hardcore scene in the States might not have happened without Machine Gun Etiquette. Because that, I feel like a lot of the early guys, you know, like Henry and Ian and a lot of the guys who sort of started hardcore, like on the West Coast, Greg Ginn obviously was obsessed with the Stooges. But on the East Coast, I feel like Machine Gun Etiquette was the first time people realized like you could play really fast.
It's funny you say that too, because it's amazing how like, you know, that Empire record hits that scene a few years later and it kind of causes that sonic shift. But you're right, like Machine Gun Etiquette, like that kind of like ferocious attack to punk rock is you know, foundational, I guess, that DC stuff early on. But I guess it's that Yesterday and Today Records, like having a record store that's like really well curated and just people like, you know, putting you on to great records.
Mm-hmm. So going back to your question about the Vatican Commando, the first 7-inch, Hit Squad for God, our friend Bill Knapp, he was a little older than us, and he had a recording studio in his basement. And so one day in, I guess it would have been 1982, the guys in the Vatican Commandos and I, we skipped school, which was, we were sissies. I mean, like, you know, like the traditional idea of like punk rockers being like confident rebels who like play by their own rules. It's like, no, we were terrified suburban kids. You know, I had a moped and I basically would have crushes on girls and never talk to them. Like we were the most terrified little, like mind our own business, suburban punk rock kids. The reason I say that is because we skipped school, and I think it's the only time any of us ever skipped school was to go make a punk rock record.
And I was going to say, and it's also for something positive in the end. You're like, you're not skipping school to go drink and do drugs. You're going to school to make, you're skipping school to make art.
Yeah. I mean, are, yeah, lowercase, but, and yeah, I mean, I was talking to someone recently and I said, like, the only reason I ever skipped classes, and I am almost ashamed to admit this, the only reason I ever skipped classes was to read books. If I was reading a book that I loved, I would skip a class so I could sit in the library and continue reading the book. Like, so my punk rock cred just completely got thrown out the window, I know.
Well, but, I don't know. I think, I was going to say, just like you were saying earlier on about, like, you know, punk rock being diminished as far as people's, like, you know, music skills in it. But, like, I think also intellectually, too, like, you know, there's a lot of heavy ideas in punk rock, especially for young people to be exposed to.
Oh, without question. You know, I mean, some were, like, one of my favorite punk rock bands who ended up becoming not a punk rock band was Adam and the Ants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first Adam and the Ants album, Dirk Wears White Socks, is a really odd punk rock record. And even the second one, and they, like, had songs about futurism, you know, this weird Italian art movement. And they had, like, talked about Lenny Bruce and had, like, so, you're right, through, like, through punk rock and, you know, interviews and reading Maximum Rock and Roll and Big Takeover, we got exposed to, like, politics and rebellion and I guess the idea, in a way, you could say, especially by the late 70s and the early 80s, like, a schism had been created between UK and US punk rock, whereas UK had gone into, like, and I still love a lot of the music, like GBH and the Exploited, but it had definitely become like drunken nihilism. You know what I mean? Like, great records, but, like, they weren't really all that, you know, nuanced or insightful in terms of, like, the things that they were talking about.
Well, like, that drunk punk UK 82 kind of punk and disorderly sound and scene type thing.
Which, I love those records, but it was an ethos of, like, have big spiky hair and get drunk on a street corner.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, very, very different than, like, what Jello Biafra's trying to do at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, you listen to Fresh Fruit for Rotting Vegetables, and, like, that was the first time my friends and I had ever heard about Pol Pot and the Cambodian genocide.
Yeah, absolutely.
Et cetera, et cetera. You know, so, like, there was a lot more, it was a lot more thoughtful. Oh, and then, so, but I still haven't fully answered your question about making that little seven at the Vatican Commando seven. So we skipped school feeling like badasses, and we went to Bill Knapp's basement in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And we recorded it. It probably, I mean, like, start to finish, the whole thing probably took 2 hours, if that, and that's with, like, breaks to eat pizza, you know, so... I mean, there was obviously, like, back in those days, there were no overdubs because no one knew what that was. Like, you put some microphones in front of your band and you played, and that was it. Like, you didn't do multiple takes. You just record. It was, you know, documenting the sound of your band.
But I guess that's why it rips still, you know, it's just like living and dying for that one record. That thing still holds up.
Oh, thanks.
I guess, like, and you were saying early on, like, you know, your band was very much a suburban kind of thing compared to, like, what was going on in New York. But you did play shows with some of those bands, right?
Yeah. I mean, one of our only claims to fame was, I believe, one of Agnostic Front's first shows was opening up for us.
That's awesome. With obviously Roger singing by that point, right?
I think so. I mean, this was just because... as you were, well, back in those days, like, you would play a show and, like, we were in Connecticut by, you know, whenever Agnostic Front started, we were one of the better known bands in Connecticut. So, like, if a band who was, you know, like, bigger elsewhere came in, oftentimes they would be, you know, we would go on after them. So technically, I think that, like, Agnostic Front, one of their shows might have been going on before us, which if it turns out that's not true, it's still a good story.
Silicus, absolutely. So what kind of bands did you play with, like, with Vatican Commandos? Was it mainly kind of those, you know, the scene bands you were talking about earlier?
Oh, is everybody, I mean, it was just this, and then, okay, then this, I have to talk about this other bit of magic that happened a little bit later in 1982, is Sean and Brian Sheridan opened a club called the Anthrax in Stamford, Connecticut. Eventually moved to Norwalk and became much more established, but originally it was just a storefront with an art gallery up top and a tiny little stage downstairs. And so now, suddenly I'm like, I'm 16 years old. No, okay, 15 years old, 15 or 16, and I have two punk rock venues within a 25-minute drive of my house. Like, this was mad. Like, honestly, it's all been downhill since then. Like, that was like the pinnacle of everything great. Like, being able to go see, you know, Circle Jerks at the Anthrax and go to see Bad Brains at Pogo's in one weekend. And then, I'm meandering, but to answer your question.
This is the bread and butter of the show. Please, Moby, go on.
So who we played with, I mean, we played with everybody from like lesser known bands like Adrenaline, OD, a lot of the Boston bands like Gangrene, Freeze. Trying to think, I'm pretty sure we opened up for Flipper. We opened up for the Misfits. We opened up for Black Flag. But when I say that, it's not like a normal person concert where there's like the opening act and the headliner. This was like, as you know, there was like
yeah, of course,
eight bands on one bill.
Yeah.
So when I say we opened up, it's like, so did everybody. Like, every Connecticut band was also on those bills.
Would bands choose between Pogo's and the Anthrax, or would they do both in the same weekend type thing?
Oh, you just did everything. I mean, like, there was no, as far as I knew, there was nothing proprietary. There was no exclusionary booking. I mean, because basically no one knew what they were doing. Like, it was kind of remarkable that anyone knew how to turn on a PA.
Yeah, there's no radius clauses or anything to get in the way of playing Pogo's and the Anthrax twice for the circuit.
Those were two words that were not part of anyone's lexicon. No.
Maybe for the better. Would these bands attract kind of the same people to them, or would it be kind of different scenes showing up to see, say, the Misfits versus AOD?
Oh, no. We all went to every show. Everybody, I mean, they're, you know, like, we, because this was also before, like, genre, like punk rock genres, the schism hadn't really happened. Like, we liked everything. I'm trying to think, was there, you know, we liked The Clash and we liked The Exploited and we liked Black Flag and we liked Adam and the Ants and we loved Bad Brains and we also loved the Ramones. Like, it was, as long as it was loosely part of the, I guess, rubric, is that the right word? Like, the mm-hmm. the sort of the punk rock, like the new wave punk rock rubric. There were some people, like, I loved a lot of synth pop. I loved, you know, a lot of much more gentle new wave. And a lot of my punk rock friends didn't like that. But within the sort of hardcore punk world, like, as far as I knew, everybody liked everything.
What about like a band like Hose? Did you ever play with them?
Yeah. Actually, that's the first time I met Rick. There was a weird show at the Anthrax. I guess it would have been spring of 1983. I think that's correct. Maybe it was 84. getting on a little bit. It's funny. Like, to me, by 84, it's like, ah. So I was already over the hill by then. So, yeah, playing at Anthrax. And I think Brian Sheridan came up to me and said, oh, this is Rick, the guitar player in the band Hose. He forgot to bring his amp. Can he borrow yours? And so that would have been the first time I met Rick Rubin, would have been, I guess, yeah, 1983 at the Anthrax. And I see him every now and then, and we still laugh about the fact that, you know, we're old.
I think it's funny, too, like, you know, it's amazing how many people in this scene, like you're saying, it's like outsiders that were drawn to punk rock. And I think still it's outsiders and people that don't necessarily feel like they fit in with the mainstream that are drawn to this thing. And how many of these people go on to do incredible things, like here yourself and Rick Rubin at a show that couldn't have had more than like, what, 200 people there at most?
Are you kidding? There were maybe 50 people. I mean, 50 was like 200. You're talking, unless I'm mistaken, like they're triple digits in the number 200. Like
yeah.
I don't think I played in front of an audience of triple digits until I was 28 years old. Like I don't remember ever being, except for like some, maybe going to some of the Rock Hotel shows in New York at the Ritz, like those were big. So like there were a lot of people there, but the shows that I'm talking about, like, I mean, Anthrax maybe held 40 people and Pogo's maybe, you know, like you could get 100 people in there, but like, no, 200 people in one place to see music back then, like that just didn't ever happen.
No, I was trying to be as generous as I could be with that, but it's still like, you know, I guess it goes to my point even more, you know. And even on the next Vatican Commando 7-inch, which I know you don't play on, but like that 7-inch cover's drawn by Rob Zombie.
Yeah, Rob was he went, I think, SVA with Jim Spad, the bass player.
It's wild how many people from this little scene wind up, you know, shaping pop culture a few years later.
Well, I know you talked to Fred Armisen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so Fred was in that scene as well. I mean, I don't remember him from back then cause he was on Long Island and Long Island was its own kind of world,
mm-hmm.
but like I see Fred all the time and, you know, that is basically the basis of our friendship is reminiscing about old punk rock.
I honestly think that's the only reason Fred tolerates me is because he knows I can nerd out with him about punk rock. So
mm-hmm. I think he might be a little bit younger than me. Cause there's definitely like a little bit of an age thing. Cause by 1984, 1985, I started moving away from the hardcore world. Largely because it started to scare me too much. Meaning, I remember this one show in particular. It would have been maybe 1984, 1985. It was, I think, Cro-Mags, Murphy's Law, Motorhead at Rock Hotel. And it was truly violent. Like, it wasn't punk rockers bumping into each other and occasionally falling down and then helping each other up. It was actual, like, blood and broken bones violence. And I remember being really like genuinely taken aback. Like I was like, oh, this isn't fun anymore. This is scary. And so that's when I kind of started, like, I still loved the music, but I stopped going to shows because there was a moment when things got really dark and violent.
Yeah. You hear about that. And you also hear kind of parallel happening, you know, a few years earlier in the West Coast with, you know, the arrival of hardcore, but it seems like when it came to New York, it was like there was a shift and things got heavier.
It shifted. Yeah. I mean, there was still I remember going to shows in New York, like seeing Black Flag at Rock Hotel at the Ritz in like 82 or 83. And it was still like, it was aggressive, but the moment someone fell down, there were five people picking him up.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to a couple years later, it just got like genuinely like people jumping on each other's heads with engineer boots and people, you know, compound fractures and skull fractures and blood. And like, it got dark and scary. And then of course it got sort of lighter, like when Gorilla Biscuits and, you know, a lot of that stuff happened, which was a lot more sort of playful in a way.
Yeah. I guess going back to, you know, even before this, like, so when, you know, you leave the Vatican Commandos, did you start AWOL immediately or was there any bands in between the two?
AWOL and the Vatican Commandos coexisted. I was only in one other band in high school and I had a huge crush on the singer. Her name was Sarah. And so I wanted to be in this band in the hopes that maybe Sarah would like me and I would finally have a girlfriend. And of course that didn't happen, but we were really bad. I mean, like really like we only played covers, and the edgiest cover we played was, Da do 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 da 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 by the Police.
That's the edgiest one.
Like we were, that was the edgiest. And so like I'm playing the Vatican Commandos, playing hardcore, playing, you know, sad gothic music in AWOL, and then desperately trying to date this woman, Sarah, and playing, like we played a Steve Miller Band cover. We played, like we were so, I think we played a Squeeze cover. Like we were so gentle. And I just wanted to have a girlfriend, and I thought this was my best way of trying to do that.
So obviously this band would not overlap with the other two projects, I imagine. Where would this band kind of play? Would it just be like cafe type shows?
Yeah, like we played in like just the cafeteria.
Okay.
We played in someone's basement while, you know, like the cool kids drank, Ballantine beer out of plastic cups. Like we were bad, and it didn't last long. And, you know, but luckily I still had, you know, the Vatican Commandos and AWOL to play in as well.
And how's a basement show going to compete with like a Bad Brain show or a Reflex from Pain show? You know,
I don't know. I mean, I guess I so desperately wanted, it was driven by like, cause as much as I loved going to hardcore shows in 80, 81, 82, the boy to girl ratio at these shows did not necessarily bode well for me wanting to have a girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no one, you didn't go to see the Bad Brains at Pogo's hoping to meet girls, because it was 99% dudes. And like, then like two or three beautiful punk rock girls who dated the cool guys in the scene who, you know, the rest of us weren't even allowed to like talk to or be in the same, you know, stand within 6 feet of.
What about AWOL though? Who would AWOL play with? Cause obviously, you know, I don't think it would fit in with the same stuff Vatican Commandos was playing with.
No, we still, I mean, there was a lot of eclecticism at these shows. So AWOL played at the Anthrax and AWOL played at Pogo's. We played a couple shows in the city, but I mean, obviously like the hardcore kids, they were polite, but they weren't into it, you know, but these bills, there was a lot of sort of eclectic overlap. You know, think of a band like Mission of Burma. I mean, Mission of Burma would play on, you know, at hardcore shows. They certainly were not a hardcore band.
No, but I was going to bring up Mission of Burma because I was first exposed to Mission of Burma through you and your cover years later. But like, did you ever play with them, or when was the first time you saw Mission of Burma?
So that record store I mentioned earlier, Johnny's, I had heard Mission of Burma on college radio and I loved it. I think I heard Academy Fight Song, or That's When I Reached for My Revolver. And I bought the Academy Fight Song 7-inch at Johnny's. And then a friend of mine bought their first EP. Is that correct? Basically some friends and I started buying their records, and the most random bit of kismet happened. I was working at a pharmacy and a woman came in to pick up her film, and she had the same last name as the bass player from Mission of Burma. And I randomly asked her, I said, "Your son, by any chance, isn't in Mission of Burma, is he?" And she said, "Yeah, that's Clint. He's my son." And so I became friends with Clint Connolly, who was obviously a few years older than me. And he was the first rock star I ever met. And I was so nervous. Like, you know, I went to his mom's house and he and I had lunch when he was home from Boston. And I brought him a copy of the Vatican Commando 7-inch. But I had never met and talked to a real rock star before. Like, he was Clint Connolly and he was in Mission of Burma and they were great. And so I don't know if I said much because I was too nervous. And then I think the second rock star I met was Ian MacKay at Great Gildersleeves.
I think those were like a, you know, probably pretty two pretty down to earth rock stars to meet for your first two.
but I was still terrified. Like I just thought like anybody in the world who made a record, they were in a different league than I was. And I simply, it was not my place to talk to them. Certainly not to talk to them as an equal, but definitely, I mean, like I just felt, you know, like I remember going up to Ian MacKay, and when I say I met him, I went up to him and said, "Mr. MacKay, my name's Moby. I just want to say, like, I'm a big fan of your band. Thank you very much."
I think I said the same thing to him when the first time I met him as well. I think that's the best way to do it, right? Like, what else are you going to say to him? Even then.
Yeah, I was too little and scared to have a real conversation with him.
What was the first time you saw Minor Threat? What show was that?
Let me think. It probably would have been that Great Gildersleeve show. Great Gildersleeves was a country western bar in the East Village, and they occasionally had punk rock shows. And so I think, because I got really lucky, a friend of mine, I guess in 81, had moved to Washington, D.C., and I went down to visit him, and we went to a cool record store, and there was this really beautiful punk rock woman working behind the counter. And I tried to endear myself to her. And so I asked her, I said, what record would she recommend? And she recommended the first Minor Threat 7-inch. Or I think the first, maybe not the first one. It was basically In My Eyes and Out of Step.
Mm-hmm.
And so I bought that and loved it. And then, yes, then we heard that Minor Threat were playing at Gildersleeves. And so we went there and I very politely introduced myself to Ian.
Did you ever see the band Why Die by any chance? From Philadelphia?
I have never heard of a punk rock band from Philadelphia. I'm ashamed to admit that.
Oh, I'm going to say definitely. You got to check out Why Die. They're the one recommendation I will impart in any way if I can. They are a fantastic hardcore band. But I guess they wouldn't have played Connecticut. Like, it's amazing how regional stuff was at that time too.
Yeah, I just like DC. We knew, I mean, thanks to Flex Your Head, thanks to, you know, like we knew all the bands from DC, you know, Teen Idols, Government Issue, Faith, Void, Minor Threat, Scream, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, like, but, and then Boston, we knew a ton of bands, New York, New Jersey, you know, like the Misfits, AOD, but Philadelphia, no, I've never heard of a punk rock band from Philadelphia.
Yeah, Why Die is awesome. But yeah, like once again, it's like it's pre-internet. There's not necessarily a way to kind of just go for search in different areas in the same way, which is much of the way I heard the AWOL 7-inch. And I wanted to ask you about the song Holy Mountain. It's kind of got like an almost X feel to it. Were they an influence at all?
Yeah, I loved and continue to love X. I mean, those first three albums, you know, Los Angeles, Wild Gift, and Under the Big Black Sun, I mean, they're just flawless.
Yeah.
Mind-boggling how good those records are. So they were definitely like, well, X and the Gun Club, that sort of, I wouldn't even know how to describe, like, tree-ish inspired punk rock. So Holy Mountain, that song, which I have not thought about since probably 1984, was definitely inspired by the Gun Club and X.
See, yeah, that's the thing. Like, I think that record, you know, holds up in a real way. And it's interesting how, you know, like it's obviously sonically going in one direction, but there's all the songs kind of do have distinct kind of vibes to them too.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought about reissuing it or no?
I haven't. Every now and then the bass player and the drummer, because we're on a text thread with each other, every now and then one of them will mention it and we sort of laugh about it, but no one's ever really seriously thought about reissuing it.
Okay, well, one day, because it's an expensive record to track down, especially with the insert and everything, but one day I think that could see the light of day. Moby, this has been unbelievable, and at some point down the line, would you come back and do a part two?
Yeah, of course. I would love, I mean, like, I feel like we just barely scratched the surface. And, you know, what's funny is I realized that I, you know, I moved to LA about 10 years ago. And at some point I realized that the majority of my friends are people from the early hardcore scene,
mm-hmm.
which is in a way kind of odd, because since then I've been involved in a lot of other music and a lot of other music scenes, but I don't have, like, I don't have any, I was a hip hop DJ for a while. I obviously made my own records. I was, you know, in the rave world, et cetera. All of my friends are old punk rockers.
I don't know. There's just something about punk rock and the people that you meet in it where there's almost like a built-in bullshit detector where you can be real with people in a different kind of way, knowing everyone.
Yeah. And ultimately everybody is a fan.
Yeah.
And everybody started tiny. Like, I had dinner, Youth of Today were playing in LA recently. So I had this dinner. Who was there? It was like Tim from Operation Ivy, Rancid, Ray and Purcell. I think maybe Walter from Gorilla Biscuits, Tony from No Doubt, Toby from H2O. So like this, like all, and like all my punk rock friends, and we were all there. And the entire conversation was what you and I just talked about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, like basically, you know, what was the B-side to this 7-inch? And did you see this show? And when was the first time you saw Fugazi? And when, just basically, like, it's like whenever punk rockers get together, we immediately become like 16-year-old kids sitting in our bedrooms.
Yeah, well, that's 100% what the genesis of this podcast has always been. It's like, you look at everyone interesting in pop culture, they either came from punk rock or they came from rap. Like, there's, you know, like at some core level, they don't have to have been in that their whole lives, but like at some point in their life, they passed through one of those two worlds and wound up doing whatever they're doing otherwise.
Yeah. And punk rock as an influence, I mean, like as a cultural influence, is so healthy, I really think, because like, and forgive me for stating the obvious, but like, everything about it was DIY. Like, if you wanted to put out a record, you had to learn how to record a record. If you wanted to release the album, you had to learn how to press vinyl. You had to bring it to the radio station on, you know, the college radio station that some friend of yours maybe was DJing on at 3 o'clock in the morning. If you wanted to play a show, you had to learn how to become a promoter. If you wanted t-shirts, you had to learn how to make t-shirts. And there was just like that DIY humility. And so even as people go on to do like much bigger things and much different things, I think you still hold on to that humility of like, you know, the thrill of being 17 years old and playing to an audience of 45 people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to ask you, like, before I let you go, like, what was that like then when all of a sudden you're at a point where, you know, you're one of the biggest entertainers in the world, you know? And like, what was that like to go from, you know, this sort of punk rock world where, especially where you have this like little Ian MacKay on your shoulder at all times, whispering in your ear, telling you, you know, like to stay that punk rock path, to all of a sudden find out that you're like a pop star?
It was complicated. I mean, I remember the first time I played a show in the early 90s and people in the audience had heard the music before I played it. And it was such that had never happened before.
Yeah.
Like people knew a song before I played it. And I was like that. And it just seemed so weird. So everything you just described was unexpected and weird to the point where I'm not even sure it happened.
Mm-hmm.
Like my punk rock history, I'm pretty sure that happened. What you just described, like selling a lot of records and playing in front of tens and hundreds of thousands of people, it's altogether possible that didn't really happen, because it shouldn't have, and it doesn't make sense. And it was just, yeah, it was just so weird. And the weirdest part was when it started to seem normal. And that's really, you know, like there's a lot of corruption and a lot of compromise in that. So I'm kind of glad that like that period of like entitlement and arrogance and self-involvement, I hope that has kind of fallen by the wayside for me. because it certainly wasn't healthy.
I kind of can only imagine what it would feel like, but I definitely get that surreal nature, and I've only experienced like a sliver of what that must have been like, because it does feel like it just might not have happened. It just could have just been a dream.
Yeah. Yep. In fact, now that we're talking, I'm pretty sure it never happened. So let's assume that, you know, my involvement with the world of music started with seeing Fear at the Mud Club and ended seeing Murphy's Law and Cro-Mags in 1984.
But then you deprived me of getting into punk rock through That's When I Reached for My Revolver being covered and me seeing the video. So I need you to stay with us, please, Moby. And also, we need you to play with us on the Bowery that all those years later, too.
Yep. Okay. So, well, we'll just sort of consign that to the world of like shadowy, it might have happened or it might not have happened.
Absolutely. Well, this show definitely happened. Moby, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, and we'll do a part two at some point.
Thank you, Moby, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Moby will be back for a part two in the near future because we got more to discuss, Moby and I. We got lots more punk stuff to get to. And in the meantime, check out Moby's brand new album, All Visible Objects, available on Little Idiot / Mute. And yeah, check it out. It's great. Moby is a... I owe this guy. The guy showed me Mission to Burma. Here I am as a young kid, you know, lost in the world. And here's Moby, this massive pop star, going, "Hey, kid, check out one of the greatest bands of all time." Flip, and then just tosses me the Mission to Burma CD. Yeah, metaphorically, I'm speaking, like by covering the record. And then Anti-Flag covered the same song on their demo, I think shortly thereafter. I think, you know, I don't think they were inspired by Moby to cover that. Ah, a conversation for another day, you know. Thank you again, Moby, for coming on this show. And, you know, in celebration of Moby being on this show, why not next week celebrate one of Moby's favorite bands and one of my absolute favorite bands, and I think probably many of your favorite bands ever. Next week on Turn Out of Punk, it's Void Week. That is right. We are going to be celebrating one of the greatest DC hardcore bands ever. There's a lot of them, but yeah, I think Void has got to be like right near the very tippy top for all of us out there. Now, maybe not all of us. Don't want to speak for you. You might be like, "Nah, I like Fugazi and Lungfish more." You might be like, "I like SOA and I'm running out of Marginal Man more." You know, like, you, who knows where you're going to go with it. But Void is certainly probably up there for you. And next week on this show, Void is number one for us. I will be joined first by Chris Stover, the bass player of Void, and then later on, a few days later on, and Bubba Dupree, for the guitar player of Void. Both, oh, they're both amazing episodes for completely different reasons. I'm very excited for you to hear them both. So that's it. Check out that new Moby record. Check out some Void. There's some Void out there. Get listen to some of that. And until we talk next week, remember, Black Lives Matter. The lives of Indigenous people matter. Go out right now. Get involved. Research. Show up. Contribute financially if you can. It's a very important time. Fuck fascism. Fuck Nazis. Stay aware of what's going on. Wear a mask. Go out there and make your own culture. And sign your organ donor card. And I love you. And I'll see you next week on the show. Thanks for listening. Bye, everyone.